Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
Woof, this is a fun one today. We're talking with my friend, Kent Masterson Brown. Kent Masterson Brown is a fascinating guy. He is a scholar of the Supreme Court and the legal system. He spent most of his career as a lawyer. He worked also in the Reagan administration. And now he has devoted this part of his life to history. And he founded an organization called Witnessing History. And it's an education foundation, and they produce films on the history of America, and they air on PBS and on a YouTube channel that they've created that has millions of views and all around the country. And they're fascinating stuff, and he's a great storyteller. And so we talked about a wide range of things. We talked about the Supreme Court nomination process that's going on right now. We talked about the greatness of America. We talked about the flaws of America. And we talked about the history of Kentucky. I think you're going to love every bit of this. So that conversation is coming up in just a second. I want to thank Louisville Cabinets and Countertops for sponsoring our podcast, 6200 Hit Lane in Louisville, Kentucky. They did our kitchen, and they did a fantastic job. So if you're looking to maybe finally get that dream kitchen in your house, I want you to call my buddy Tim at Louisville Cabinets and Countertops, 502-930-3304. I was so impressed with their work ethic when they came into my house to do the work in our kitchen, and then we eventually had them do our master bath, and they just do phenomenal work. They have a very it's a strong work ethic. It's why I gravitated to them in the first place, and they do great work. And you can see some of the work that they do on their website at LouisvilleCabinetsAndCountertops.com. And so we thank them for being a sponsor of this program. All right, let's get to the conversation we had with the great Kent Masterson Brown. On here just a second. I'm getting in shape because I'm doing my first elk hunt in late October.
Oh really?
Yeah. I wow. Got a tag, and my nephew is coming, and we are going to go out to the backside of Rocky Mountain National Park to this place called Never Summer Wilderness. And that's where we're going to be hunting. And it's everything that we'll be doing will be above 10,000 feet in elevation. And so I'm just trying to get ready with packs and climbing and everything, just because this isn't like your typical get in a Kentucky farm tree blind, sit there all day and, you know, cover yourself with deer pee and wait till they come to you. This is, we got to find the bull, you know, the bull elk somewhere, wherever he is. And he's a wily creature.
You shoot the thing. Then how are you going to get the carcass back?
So that's part of the problem. Like, logistically, I was talking to a buddy of mine that does a lot of elk hunts, and he said, both of you take sleds up. So you get these lightweight sleds, and then you can put them on your pack when you're going in. And then if, by the 1% chance we actually get an elk, then we basically can load up sections of it and put it on that, on that sled, and then drag the sled back to the vehicle, some 5 miles away at the max. So that's,
or let
that's,
the sled go ahead of you and it drag you back.
Get on top of it, ride it down, whatever has to happen. So
I have kind of a cartoon brain.
Yeah. that would be exactly how my trip's probably gonna go. So well, I am recording. I tell you what, it's great to have Kent Masterson Brown back with me. We've had a lot of fun on the radio over the years, but the interesting thing is, on the radio, we're always trapped by these blasted 7-minute segments that have to end in a commercial break. And now we have a podcast that we can sit here and chat for a few minutes and go with the flow of it. And there's a lot of things I want to talk to you about because of your wide-ranging expertise. I want to talk about the Supreme Court, and I want to talk about your Witnessing History series. And there's a real reason I want to focus in on that, because there's an effort among certain elements of society today to erase our history, and you are devoting this portion of your set of goals and dreams to actually doing the opposite, and that is reminding us of our history. And I find that fascinating, and it's got to be fulfilling for you to be following
that. Well, it is. It is. It is. I just reached a point in life where after 47 years of law practice, and I wrote books and made films during that time. But I finally said, look, you know, how much time do you have left in life? And do you want to do that, or you really want to do something you're just absolutely devoted to? And I'm devoted to American history. I love it. And I love to talk about it. And I like educate others about it. And so that's what I'm doing.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I was just going to say you have a fascinating way of telling a story. I mean, it's a compliment. No, so my wife and I were watching the first episode of the Daniel Boone series.
Yeah.
Last night, and at the end of it, I turn it off. She goes, "I can't wait to see the next part."
Oh.
And then she goes, "I just love the way he tells a story." And I was like, "I know, it's awesome. It's just really compelling."
Thank you. History can only be told by storytelling. I mean, and have people understand it,
right,
and love it. So that's part of the game, to make sure people enjoy what they hear and see.
Yeah, and there has to be. I think, you know, a mentor of mine in the radio industry once told me. He said, to always surprise the audience. And by surprising them, he didn't mean to veer from your principles. If you change your principles, they're going to know it. You have to be authentic. But his point was to come at things with a take that nobody had heard or nobody had thought of. And one of the things, the first thing out of the gate in that first part of the Daniel Boone series, the very first thing out of the gate was like you listed like five facts that were the opposite about Daniel Boone than what I had thought and had heard, which surprised me and immediately engaged me, because now I had to watch the whole thing because I was like, I got to find out, why is it Daniel Boone is supposed to be wearing a coonskin cap when he absolutely hated the things? I mean, like that, it totally took me off guard. I love that.
Yeah. Well, he did. He never wore a fur hat, and always wore a broad-brimmed hat, which, frankly, most of the frontiersmen did, too. It's just practical. It shades your eyes from the sun. It helps you when it's driving rain. And these fellas are out in the outside all the time.
Right.
And so you want to wear something that works.
It seems as though maybe that sort of coonskin cap or that fur hat would have been much more useful to the explorers of the Rocky Mountains out west than of something here in the east, where it got cold, but not quite that cold. And like you said, more of the threat from sun and rain and those kinds of elements than you would have from frigid deep freeze type cold all the time.
Yeah. You would see fur hats more, you know, in the far northern and western climes in America.
Right.
But still, even those guys out there would most likely prefer a broad brimmed hat.
That's fascinating. So I want to come back. I want to come back to the history, and I want that to be the bulk of our conversation today. But let me start with this, because it's going on right now, and that is. Amy Coney Barrett is the nominee for filling the spot on the Supreme Court. I want to get your thoughts on this and the discussion that's going around about, and I don't want to get political. It's not a left or right thing, but just really it's about the Supreme Court. I do want to state and see if you agree with what I'm about to say. And if not, feel free to totally quibble and tell me I'm wrong. But I feel like that there's a huge apples to oranges difference between this nomination and the one of Merrick Garland under Obama's presidency. And here's the difference. President Obama was outgoing no matter what. He wasn't running for reelection. It was a new president coming in regardless. And so the argument that a sitting president in a late part of his last term might allow, even if it was someone of the same party, to be the person to make that nomination and set their stamp on things versus now, where America has a long tradition of giving most presidents a second term. So this is still about President Trump's agenda. And we have a potentially very close election with some really strange challenges to the way we vote this time that is unprecedented. Therefore, a tied 4-4 court would be, regardless of whether the person who is selected is right or left or whoever or whatever, a tied court would be bad for the nation. So I feel like it's actually the president's right and responsibility to make this nomination, and it's the and it's the Senate's responsibility to confirm it quickly so that there isn't that unknown hanging out there. Do you agree with that?
I do. I do agree with that. Mine might be even simpler, and that is that it is always the president's constitutional duty to nominate. And that's the Constitution gives him that authority. And if he has a majority in the Senate, then it gets confirmed. And that's just the way it is. You know, that's what the people said at the last election.
Right.
And we can't say they won't say that again or will say that again. It's that what that's what they said. And there is a that's the genius of the system, frankly.
Right. Right. He has 4 years.
Yes.
And
yes.
Even to that point, even President Obama was fully in the right. And we might say that at that time, we might say that that Mitch McConnell was wrong at that time to deny him that nomination, because the president has 4 years, not not 3 years and 364 days. He has 4 years.
Yes. And by the way, you know, I personally liked Merrick Garland. I have argued in front of him. He ruled for me in the U.S. Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia. And I've argued in front of Brett Kavanaugh. And I rather liked Garland's approach more than I did Kavanaugh.
Really?
To be honest. Yeah, as an appellate judge.
Yeah.
I did. And Kavanaugh wrote an opinion in a case that ruled against me, even though he had a huge dissenter on that panel. And it took the Trump administration to just on its own reverse the whole thing.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. But Merrick Garland's a nice fellow. And
He was moderate from my understanding.
He's a moderate fellow. Yeah. I wouldn't necessarily call him middle of the road, but he was moderating. And he'd listen to a good argument. And so, I mean, but still, you know, if you don't have a majority with you in the Senate, then that's just part of the deal.
Right. Right. Yeah, because the president has the right and responsibility to make that nomination. Yeah. That doesn't guarantee the nomination will be confirmed.
In that case,
Obama did not have the Senate, and so the Senate had its prerogative. And again, like you said, that's the beauty of the system.
That's the beauty of the system. Right. If it all just went according to oil.
Well, don't you think that Justice Ginsburg was right? This disgusting nonsense of the Democrats talking about packing the court. And I would say the same thing if it was the Republicans talking about it, because by its very nature, packing the court is to make the court political. That's Justice Ginsburg's words. Can they do that? Do you think they'll break that precedent? Because, I mean, obviously, constitutionally, there's really nothing stopping the Democrats from adding five more justices if they want. But it would break the system.
That historically has proven to be a disaster, and a disaster for the party doing it. It was before under Roosevelt, and who knows what they might do. I mean, Lord, I'm through guessing about things that might happen
America
over there.
It's
just unbelievable.
Yeah.
So, you know, they may not, I don't know. You've got to take them at their word. I mean, that's what they say they want to do.
Yeah.
And so, whatever.
But it would inherently make the court political, which removes the check and balance. I mean, the whole point of the court is to check and balance the legislature. and the executive branch. And if the executive branch and legislature are making the court what they want it to be, you've completely erased that check and balance.
Yeah, to be very honest, these courts, after 47 years of practicing in them, I mean, they're political animals. Now, they really are. However, to do that makes it so grossly political that it's, you know, what happens is the public loses faith in it.
Yeah, right.
And that's the great danger in any of this is, is the public going to lose faith? And the minute it does, you've got a government that can't govern.
Right. That's a great point. You mentioned arguing before Kavanaugh. You mentioned arguing before Garland. What's your take on Amy Coney Barrett?
Well, you know, I've been in the Seventh Circuit once. That's in Chicago, which is where she sits. But it was long before she became a judge. And I don't know a great deal about her. Other than what I read, and she seems like a very attractive candidate nominee. She has great credentials. She went to a college I'm rather familiar with, Rhodes College. I went to Center College, which has played Rhodes College in football and basketball and everything else for years. They're in a similar conference, same conference. And it's a very fine school, and she did very well there, and then went to Notre Dame, and apparently was a student at Notre Dame, and has had some tremendous experience as a law clerk under Justice Scalia. I mean, you can't find a candidate coming out of the U.S. Court of Appeals who has more to give and offer than someone like that.
Do you find her
irrespective of politics?
Right.
She seems to have, you know, what that kind of an office takes.
There's so much of that coming from both sides talking about her that way, meaning that there's Democrats, there's liberals, there's people that have said, look, you know, I'm on the other side of the political aisle from this thinking, but this person is an astounding person. She's a person of good character.
Yes, she is.
And that's ultimately what we want. Because I don't want quote unquote conservative justices.
No.
I don't want liberal justices. I want textualist constitutional judges. And I hope that's what she would be.
I think having been tutored by Antonin Scalia, that's exactly what she'd be.
Right. But isn't that what, you know, obviously when we say textualist, let's explain what we mean by that. We mean that we want judges that because the whole point of the Supreme Court is not to change law. It is to interpret it and say this doesn't fly based on what the founders said, or this does fly based on what the founders said. That's it.
That's right. You know, it's really fascinating. And I think you and I have talked about this on the air before. The Scalia will venture to try to conjure up the names of the titles of the cases, but where he became an ardent textualist was found that when he came to interpret any phrase in the Constitution, he'd go to the words that are in that phrase and look them up in dictionaries published in 1787 and 1789. And he'd say, this is what they meant.
Right.
And of course, there's your textualist.
Indeed, right?
He was phenomenal in that. And that is what you do. You find out what did the framers intend. I've always look down on this idea that this is so-called a living document, and we can kind of wrench it in any direction we want to take it, and it becomes nothing at all.
Right.
And it is something. It's the roadmap to how to govern this country. And you can't fool with it.
Right.
You gotta take it for what it is, or get a new one.
Well,
and
the devil's advocate side of that discussion, and I understand where they're coming from. I agree with you, but I understand where they're coming from. The left seems to make sense when they say, but times have changed, and therefore we must flow with it. And there's a certain element of that. But here's where I come back to your argument, and that is this. The Constitution was not extremely limiting. In fact, it was not limiting at all. There was very little limitation in it other than to say this is what government cannot do. And what it was saying was there are certain – this is the whole entire framework of the document is this. There are certain inalienable human rights. Now, granted, they didn't have it all right at the time, but fortunately the language in it allowed for that conflict to arise so that we could fix it. But the essence of the document is – This is the framework for rights given to man, not by government. You cannot touch these. And to me, that's basically saying it doesn't matter whether it's 1,000 years from now, 1,000,000 years from now. These inalienable, in essence, to human being rights will not change. So what we can do is carve at where we're contradictory to our own language, i.e. slavery and the way we were not allowing women to vote and so on and so forth, we can carve at where we were contradictory. But those in that's really all towards pushing to make sure all men and women do have those rights that are outlined in it. Am I wrong?
No, you're absolutely right. Absolutely right.
To me, that's the argument for textualism.
Yes. Yes. And where someone might say, well, but they had kind of sub silentio permitted slavery. Well, that was resolved constitutionally
Because of the language in the document.
Because
fortunately,
of the language,
fascinating stuff. All right, let's talk a little history here. The first reason I want to talk history is because we do have elements in our society that are attempting to erase it, and I think there is there's an effort afoot here to take advantage of what I think is a legitimate conversation about the police interaction with people in our society, especially people who are minorities. I think that's a legitimate discussion about reforming how we interact, ways that we can try to, bring about better equal opportunity across the board. Totally legitimate conversation. There's elements in the political spectrum, though, that are seizing upon this, taking advantage of it, and then using it to go a huge step farther than that legitimate discussion and try to do something that we know is something that people who believe in Marxism and communism know need to happen, and that is to completely erase history and establish a new history. And that's the driving element behind the idea of cancel culture and the idea of getting rid of statues and getting rid of anything that harkens back to a time when our America was less perfect than we are now. We're not at all perfect. That is terrifying to me, and it's got to be terrifying to a guy like you who recognizes that we weren't perfect at that time, but that it's important to know where we came from.
Well, of course. Of course. No, it is terrifying to me. And it's the thing that has prompted me to devote the rest of my life to doing this. What we do is we make documentary films on American history, and we raise the capital to do it as a 501c3. We make the film off of what we raise, and then we literally give those films to the PBS, the Public Broadcasting Network. We give them to cable television. We put them on streaming sites. We have our own streaming channel. And right now, that I looked at it early this morning, that channel now has 1,530,000 views.
That's awesome.
And it's only been up like 9 months or so.
Wow.
10 months. And we have 8 films on it, plus a lot of podcasts. And we're getting ready to start yet the production of another film. And then heaven knows this one film we finished last fall on Abraham Lincoln's years in Illinois, It's titled "In the Declaration, All Men Are Created Equal." Abraham Lincoln in Illinois, 1830 to 1860, and it covers his years from the time he shows up at New Salem as he called a piece of floating driftwood, is what he referred to himself as. Just had no education formally at all, save for weeks here or a month there in a blab school. And within 7 years, that fellow makes himself a member of the bar of the state of Illinois. Mm. And that starts a law and political career for him. And when Stephen Douglas introduces a bill in Congress to allow the Kansas-Nebraska territory to, when states petition for statehood, to determine for themselves whether or not they want slavery or not, popular sovereignty, Lincoln becomes alarmed because it's above the Missouri Compromise line.
Right.
And he then goes to the books, studies the Declaration of Independence and the debates in the Second Continental Congress, and then the debates in the Congress before, or the Confederation Congress, and the debates after the Constitution was ratified over the expansion of slavery and whether or not Congress has power to limit it in the territories, and finds that the majority of the framers believed that Congress had every right to limit slavery from the territories. And even twice a bill was introduced in Congress limiting slavery in the Northwest Territory, mm-hmm. before the Constitution and after the Constitution. And that bill was signed, not only passed Congress, but signed by George Washington as President of the United States after the ratification of the Constitution. So when you look at George Washington, did he have problems with slavery? He daggone did. As did virtually all the framers, because most of those guys were sitting in Congress and passed this.
Right.
So this is Lincoln now. This is Lincoln speaking. And he says that just with incredible clarity when he gives the Cooper Union Address in February 1860. And right after that, he becomes the Republican nominee come May, and, of course, wins the election in 1860. But that was his hallmark speech, was that, counting heads in Congress before and after the Constitution, so that he could tell the public truthfully that most of those framers were opposed to slavery and wanted to see it put on a course of extinction.
So along comes Lincoln, mm-hmm. and he forces the discussion that America had needed to have from the very beginning.
And
Lincoln was passionately abolitionist from the beginning.
No, he wasn't. He was accused of that. But his argument was, we've got to simply find a mechanism to put slavery on a course of ultimate extinction.
Right.
So that's, you limit it, you take it out of the territories.
What I mean is, when free. I guess abolitionist at the time would have been considered a loaded term, because mm-hmm. they wanted it gone immediately. But I mean, yes. Abraham Lincoln abhorred the institution of slavery, wanted it ended. I guess his goal was to end it the best way possible.
The best way possible.
Ultimately, right. We still ended up having to have a civil war over it.
Yeah. Again, because of fear.
How did we get to women's suffrage? So these are like the big debates of our history, right? Like, so we started with the Civil War over slavery, which fortunately, thank God, abolished that horribleness. Mm-hmm. Then we move on to, for some reason, we weren't allowing women to vote. What brought us to that? I mean,
really, the best way to put it is an ancient thing. I mean, societies in Western civilization were always governed by men for centuries.
Right.
And it was no different here than it was in Great Britain, where the vote was the man. Vote was not only a man, but he had to be a property owner. Mm-hmm. So you know, the poor for eons were never considered.
Right.
And it's not something unique to America. It was brought here from Western Europe and England. And so it just took time for that to slowly, and what I love about America is that there is always a way it can be remedied.
Right.
You know, and there's always redemption.
Right.
I'm a believer in redemption.
Yeah, that's what I think the forces that are trying to erase our history are trying to obfuscate this point.
Yeah.
And that is that. Yeah. You know, when I look back, like, for instance, as you know, my parents are missionaries on the American Indian field.
Yeah.
I grew up on an Indian reservation.
Right.
I have a very sensitive spot for how Native Americans were treated.
Sure.
Especially in the West.
Sure.
There was a lot of complicated relationships. One of the most surprising things I learned from your Daniel Boone thing last night was that we didn't steal Kentucky from Native Americans. We bought it from them. We bought it from them. We literally, and the Cherokee probably thought they were getting a hell of a deal because they considered it the dark and bloody ground, and it was always a contested area anyway. And they're like, check these guys out. We're going to get a whole bunch of stuff from them, and they're going to take over this crap land.
And you know, what's really amazing is that not one Indian tribe,
right,
either the Cherokee or the Shawnee or anyone like ever lived here.
Right. They didn't really claim it. It was just they hunted there. It was like, so we were like, okay, we'll do it. And gave them money in the process. But the Western lands is much more complicated in terms of how we went about manifest destiny and all of that. But I think what really fascinates me is that somehow through all of this imperfection, those founding original documents, so when you get back to textualism in the Constitution and in Supreme Court, those founding original documents were so pure in intention in terms of the inalienable rights of mankind, to set up these future points at which we would have these societal inflections until we perfected it. In other words, follow this guide, and as you say, there will always be redemption. And there are forces in our schools that are trying to convince children otherwise about this great experiment in self-government, that somehow or another an all-powerful state can come in and fix all of these problems with humans, whereas our founders sort of knew we had to reach enlightenment and we had to have a path and a set of guidelines upon which to travel that way to enlightenment. And that's what America has always been about, is becoming more and more and more enlightened, which I think is why we rose to such greatness. And now we're trying to undermine that, which is what's causing us as an empire to fall, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. And you not only look at the Constitution, but you do what Lincoln did. You look at the Declaration of Independence. It's not a relic of the American Revolution.
Right.
It is a document that became as its framers intended, became an American creed. And you cannot read the Constitution without reading into it the words of the Declaration of Independence.
Right.
That governments are instituted among men to protect their property, to protect their right to life and liberty. That's what governments are instituted to do. And I mean, it's as simple as it can be.
Right. The very essence of America is that each man is his own kingdom.
That's
not
right.
Not that we dominate other people. But that we achieve whatever we want to achieve through our effort and through our thrift and through our ingeniousness and through our intelligence and whatever we throw at life, that we develop our own. This is the whole point of of, you know, a modern day couple's financial plan. That is the goal. That is the dream for everyone to be able to equally partake in that.
Yeah, and as you said, I mean, the Declaration says that these rights were given to us by our Creator.
Right.
And governments are instituted among men to protect them.
Right. Right.
Bang. That's it.
So let's talk about Daniel Boone for a little bit.
I love him.
So fascinating. So as a Kentuckian, obviously Daniel Boone is ensconced in my brain.
Yeah.
You know, he's the great hero of the Wild Wild West of Kentucky. People today don't think of Kentucky as the Wild Wild West, but in fact it was at that time.
It really, yeah.
And your series on Witnessing History, the Daniel Boone series, is fascinating. It starts off with a series of things I had no idea. They were completely antithetical to the legends that I had heard growing up. We mentioned the fur cap. He never wore one.
Right.
There's tell me how this guy came to be. Why was he so fascinated with Kentucky?
Well, of course, he came from very, very little. He had very little, like most of those who came into Kentucky in the years right before and during the Revolution. He happened to be a superior woodsman, which he just became that by doing it. Mm-hmm. His family had migrated to North Carolina from Pennsylvania, where he was born in Pennsylvania. And as he grew up, after meeting John Finley as a wagoner in Braddock's defeat during the French and Indian War, he learned that there was this place across the mountains that Finley painted as being a paradise. And indeed, one just has to drive around rural central Kentucky, and it is a paradise. Mm-hmm. You know, enormous streams, underground water, sinking springs. There's springs all over the place. It's an absolutely spectacular place to settle.
Right.
And when Boone first came in here in 1769 with Finley, he got a glimpse of it and resolved he's going to bring his family here. These are the people who drove America across the mountains. And once they got across the mountains, these same people kept going on like a rolling stone.
Right.
And this is how the country was settled, by people like that. And Boone, he lived a life in many ways, frankly, not too dissimilar from most every other settler here. It's just that in 1783, John Finley, a schoolteacher from Philadelphia, came out here and composed a book on the discovery and settlement of Kentucky that was published in 1784, 86, I can't remember. In the process, he came across Daniel Boone, then living at a place called Boone Station, which you remember, Leland, Athens, Kentucky.
Yep.
In the civilized world, it's Athens, but here it's
right,
Athens.
Right.
It's right outside of Athens, Kentucky. And
Athens, Boonesboro.
Athens, Boonesboro Road, right. And you go through Athens to get to Boonesboro.
Right.
But he came and settled there in 1779 after he had been tried and acquitted for treason. Which is yet another story you'll go into in part two of the movie when you watch it. But John Finley, the John Filson found Boone in his cabin at Boone Station and interviewed him. And this is what's really neat. It was a lengthy interview, and it turned out to be Boone's autobiography, because Filson published his book with Boone's autobiography as an appendix. And that book was published almost in every Western European country published and republished all over America.
Right.
And Boone suddenly became the most celebrated frontiersman ever.
Yeah.
And it shows you the power of publication.
Right.
You get something in print, there's meaning to that. And for Boone, it really set him up as a, not because he wanted to, he just sat there and was interviewed.
Right.
And so in the film, you'll hear Boone speak on various things. And most all of those passages where you hear Boone speak come from his autobiography.
So there's one question I had for you about the first in the series on Daniel Boone. He, at one point, they were in Kentucky and they were circling around following the buffalo or the bison.
Yeah.
And what was interesting was fascinating. Like today, Kentucky, I think, looks quite different than it must have at that time because of really industrial farming and modern technology and roads crisscrossing everything. But at the time, the bluegrass region would have been quite a stunning sight because it's ringed by those limestone sort of rolling hills and knobs all the way around. And literally you can follow a ring of knobs almost all the way around in a circle. And then there's this sort of depression in the middle of gently rolling land that at the time was basically just wide open meadows with trees. And that was great habitat for bison, right? So he's wandering around in Kentucky. They get captured by Indians and they get a free and then blah, blah, blah. And they catch all these pelts. And then one of his guys, I think it was Finley, is like, I'm going to go, or no, it was Squire Boone. And he's like, I'm going to go take all these back. I'm going to sell them. And I'll come back and bring supplies.
Yeah.
And my wife looks at me, she pauses the TV and she looks at me, she goes, why did he stay by himself? He stayed in Kentucky literally by himself.
By himself.
Hiding from Indians, you know, all this, singing hymns, getting, you know, run crossing hunting parties, all this crazy.
Yeah.
Why did he do that? What was his purpose in just staying and wandering around Kentucky? Nah, I'm not going to go see my wife and seven kids. I'm just going to hang out here in the middle of nowhere where no one lives and run away from people who are trying to, you know, cut my hair off.
I wish I could get into his head. I can't because I wish I really knew him.
Right.
I mean, really knew him, like, you know, shake hands guy. He loved being solitary.
Right.
There are people like this, you know, who like moments and time by themselves. There are. It's not that he was antisocial or anything like that. It's just that he valued quiet and solitude.
Right. Can you imagine if we gave him an iPad?
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. But that is one of the most delightful parts of his life out here, was he just out here by himself. And, you know, he gets captured and then released. And I mean, he goes through all sorts of stuff.
Right.
These Indians, these Native Americans are just hunting parties.
Right.
They're not living here.
Right.
But they don't want him here. But it's not because he's taking their land that they're living on. They don't. And what few villages ever sprung up here among the historic Indians were quickly evacuated.
Right.
And we had a lot of prehistoric Indians here, mound builders and those. But they're prehistoric, and they all vanished.
Right.
And so when Boone came in here, there was nothing.
Right. Why was there nothing? Why was Kentucky so unique? Because really, if you drive, this is what's interesting about the East Coast, right?
Mm-hmm.
Out West, when you drive 5 minutes, everything looks totally different than it did 5 minutes ago.
No, I know.
You drive through the East, and as a born Kentuckian, yes, I know the difference between Kentucky and Tennessee. I know the difference between Kentucky and Virginia in terms of just terrain.
Right.
I know the difference between Kentucky and Ohio. Ohio, we can give to Russia if we want. I don't care. But but really, from a 20,000 foot view in current modern times, there isn't that striking a difference between the terrain. There's gradual changes, but there's not really that striking a difference between the terrain. So what was it about Kentucky? Did it look vastly different to the eye at that time? And what was it about it that was so fascinating And yet, why didn't anyone want to live there if that was the case?
Well, for the Native American tribes, it was they fought over it.
Okay.
And
no one could actually settle it because they kept fighting over it. So they wanted it so bad they couldn't have it.
Right. I've often said to people, somewhat facetiously, that had the white settler not come in here, that the Indian tribes would have slaughtered one another.
Right.
One of them would have been extinct.
Right.
Because the wars they fought over Kentucky were just horrific, and by the time Boone had an interest in Kentucky, both of these northern tribes and southern tribes had basically regarded Kentucky as off limits, except maybe a hunting party.
Right.
And Kentucky was great for hunting. I mean, you mentioned bison. What really brought the bison here were the huge
the salt licks?
Fields of cane.
Oh, okay.
They ate the cane, and they not only ate the cane, but then there were in the limestone bed there were salt springs.
Right.
And what we call licks.
Right.
We call them licks because the bison would lick that. They wanted the salt. And these were all along the Licking River.
Right.
Places like Mays Lick. And, I mean, they're all over Kentucky, towns like that.
Right.
And to the buffalo, as you saw in the film, would follow a path from the Great Miami River across the Ohio, which they would wade across the Ohio River. Imagine that. But without the dams, the Ohio River would fall in the summer. They'd wade across it and follow this enormous paths through central Kentucky. So when Boone comes in here, I mean, he actually sees pathways carved by tens of thousands of bison that totally cut around and through central Kentucky. So all the fortified stations that were built up, Boonesboro and Bryan Station and all these other stations, were built along traces.
Huh.
I mean, you have a road network.
Yeah.
It's just incredible.
And once you got over the mountains, the terrain was a lot easier to navigate, yet still fascinating and beautiful.
Oh, yeah, it's gorgeous. Yeah. Absolutely gorgeous. And you've got, there's an enormous amount of underground water in the limestone bed here.
Right.
And that limestone bed makes for tremendous livestock. That's why graze.
Race horses and good bourbon,
yes,
buddy.
Yes, absolutely. It's the limestone bed and the prominence of that water that caused the distilling business to start in Kentucky. And it is also the reason that every horse breeder brings his horse here to graze.
Right. Do you know the best tasting water I've ever had in my life was down, I think it was, I think it's Loch Nine on the Kentucky River up against the limestone cliff. There's spring, a natural spring that comes out of the cliff.
And
somebody put a pipe in it just so it would kind of trickle out and you could stick your glass under it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's ice cold, even in the hot, hot summer, because it's been just trickling through the caves there. I mean, it's ice cold, and it has almost a sweetish, like a sweet taste to it. Like it's so delicious. I can taste it right now, a glass of that, and it's pure. I mean, it's absolutely pure because it's coming out of that limestone. It's completely filtered. It was so delicious.
Yeah. It's spectacular. Yeah. It is utterly spectacular.
So once we got our claws into Kentucky, that's when the Europeans were going to come west, and we established it. It was very difficult to do, because one of the fascinating parts of the Daniel Boone series you talk about was that about the time that Kentucky was being settled was also about the time that we were about to go to war with the Empire of Great Britain,
right.
And Great Britain had already established a number of network alliances with these tribes that had been warring over the land in Kentucky. So here we have maybe the one piece of land nobody actually occupies that we pour into, and now the British are going to ally with these Native Americans. And interestingly, they just make the Native Americans do all the work, and
exactly
and
right.
it becomes a bloody ground during
yes,
that
exactly.
period of time.
Exactly. You wonder, had there not been the American Revolution, what would have eventuated here?
Right.
Something far different than what happened, for sure.
Right.
Because every one of those invasions of Kentucky that led to bloodshed during the Revolution was planned by British forces. And they used the Shawnee, the Miamis, the Wyandots, all those Great Lakes tribes
right.
to just do their bidding.
Right.
And they were happy to do it because they got stuff for doing it.
Right.
Muskets, flints, powder, lead, hatchets, you name it. And
the British paid them for scalps.
And they paid them for scalps.
Fascinating.
Yeah. It's unbelievable. And so when you talk about, you know, the fighting out here, it's the British. You know, I'll tell you, I'm mostly English in descent, but you got to say, they are the bloodiest bunch who ever existed.
Yeah.
They really are.
No
I
doubt.
Mean,
why were
they love war, I think.
Why? Well, they love conquering.
They're conquering. They want to control. We'll make it all England.
Right.
You know, this
right.
sort of thing.
Why were they so fascinated with Kentucky, though, in the Revolutionary War? Were they just wanting a Western? I mean, it's not exactly easy to attack Virginia from the West. So why were they so interested in a ragtag group of people who were just trying to get away from other people
mm-hmm.
and settle Kentucky? Because that's essentially what it was. It was a lot of pacifist Quakers and, you know, just people that were like, get away from me, all society, right? Like, that's really what Kentucky was just trying to get away from that. Why was Britain so interested in it?
Well, I mean, you're talking about a revolution that's it's continental
right.
in scope. And Britain does not have the manpower to fight a war like that.
Right.
And it just doesn't, nor does it have the money. Frankly, the whole revolution begins because Britain was so heavily in debt after the Seven Years' War with France, the French and Indian War, that it wanted to tax the American colonies to pay for it, because so much of it was fought in North America.
Right.
And so, you know, yet the colonies paid a lot of that themselves to send troops to various spots during the French and Indian War.
Right.
And they really disagreed with Britain, you know, telling we're going to tax you, when they don't have anybody from their own colony sitting in Parliament.
Right.
Who are you?
Right.
Why aren't we represented anywhere?
Right.
Well, and of course, the minute they began to object to paying the tax, then Britain, instead of trying to sit down and reasonably go through this, which the British never have been known to do, they started putting punitive measures on them. We'll close the damn port of Boston.
Right.
In one punitive measure after another, to the point where, what are you going to do, starve us out? We can't earn any money. We can't. We're disenfranchised, and eventually that led to a clash.
Right.
And it led to a clash, interestingly, because Britain wanted to go out there and try to find a stash of arms that the citizens had been piling up,
right,
in case something bad happened.
Ah, the Second Amendment.
And on this is what the birth of the Second Amendment. And on their way to Concord, they met a militia company on the green in Lexington, and immediately fired on them, killing eight, and then marched farther toward Concord, and then were met by literally thousands of militiamen, and were had to retreat back to Boston, and it was a bloody retreat. They were sniped at all the way back to Boston, and then 20,000 armed militiamen show up on the heights surrounding Boston. And now the British are penned in Boston by a ragtag militia that numbers 20,000.
Wow.
It's unbelievable, really.
Yeah. That's fascinating.
And,
I love it. It's like I want to go into the whole big old thing on that now.
But by the way, that's our next film is on the coming of the revolution.
Well, I can't wait for that to come out. I want to ask you. I want to ask you one more question about Kentucky, but real quick on the Second Amendment.
Yeah.
I hear a lot of the left. They're like, "Oh, it was just about raising a militia," which is the dumbest interpretation of it. Like, it is word for word. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state.
Mm-hmm.
The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. There's no question what the intent of that amendment was by the framers.
No.
The intent of that, the security of a free state, the intent of this was that the people should have the same arms as the so-called government in order to keep their state free. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. To say that this was somehow so that we could raise a militia quickly is to ignore the very meaning of the words right in front of you in the statement of the Second Amendment.
That's correct. That's correct. And by the way, the Supreme Court, Antonin Scalia, writing the majority opinion, said just that.
Right. It's bam, done. Okay,
bam. Right.
So I want to give people an opportunity to know where to find your stuff. But before, I have one last question about Kentucky, and it was raised by one of the things I didn't know until I watched your piece. Mm-hmm. Was I had always thought that Kentucky was stolen from Native Americans.
Mm-hmm.
It was not. It was, in fact, mostly bought from the Cherokee tribe, who didn't own it either. So the Cherokee were brilliant. They were the first used car salesman to sell a car that had no engine. They're like, here, we'll take you. I love that story. I think that's fascinating. So you had the Transylvania Company, which, and at the time, based on watching your film, it looks like the Cherokee didn't really have the right to sell it either. They were just here. But one of the things they said when they made this deal with the Cherokee, the Cherokee warned them and said, look, we couldn't control it either. Okay.
Yeah.
There's these tribes. They come in. They don't live there, but they're going to fight you. Just be warned. Right. And they're vicious.
That's
and
right.
they're very right. skilled warriors. So understand right. this.
Yeah.
And the Cherokee leaders said that something to the effect of there's a cloud over that place.
Yes.
Now, here's something that's interesting.
Dragging Canoe.
Dragging Canoe. Yes, that was his name. Dragging Canoe said there's a cloud over that place. The Native Americans knew it as the Dark and Bloody Ground. You had people settling it who were trying to get away from civilization. They weren't trying to take sides. Then you had the rise of the state itself, and it's the moniker is two people shaking hands, united we stand, divided we fall. Yeah. Throughout the Civil War, we could never decide what side of anything we were on. Throughout history, and I can say this because I am a Kentuckian, and this is what leads to my question. Throughout history, Kentuckians have been reticent to change. We've been reticent to get involved in debates. We don't want to take a side. We just want to go about our lives and have people leave us alone. And it's like, do you think it's possible for certain physical places to have sort of spiritual elements attached to them? Because Kentucky has been this place where the people here have always wanted to avoid combat, fight, whatever.
Yeah.
And yet it has always come to be a boiling thing, you know, like in the Civil War, they were like, decide which side you're on, damn it. You know, I mean, Lincoln was known to have said, without Kentucky, we can't have the Union. And yet, as a state, even to this day, you know, we are reticent to change, reticent to engage in debate, reticent to do these things. And brother fought against brother from the state. Do you think it's possible for a location, geographic location, to have a spiritual thing attached to it that just stays with that place?
Oh, I do. I do think that's true. Kentucky, though, you know, is the ultimate neutral ground. It's sandwiched between the Ohio River and Tennessee. And if you look, if you want to do business, you've got to look to the Ohio River. And of course, it's bordered by Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois. And so you've got to look there if you want to do business, because every one of our streams runs north out of Kentucky into the Ohio.
Right.
And so if you want to send your goods somewhere, you're making whiskey or whatever, you send them on the river nearest to you, north toward the Ohio River. So you have to look north. Yet Kentucky had all the apparatus of those slave owning states in the South.
Right.
And so we had 250,000 African American slaves in Kentucky, according to the census of 1860. And it's an enormous number for a state that was so populated with so few and settlers, period. And yet, so it's looking north, but it's also looking south.
Right.
It regards itself as a southern state, but it's not.
Right.
And so not only do you have the spiritual thing, but I think that spiritual thing comes about because of its situation geographically.
Right.
Sandwiched between two entirely different cultures, particularly in the 18th and 19th centuries.
Right.
It was between two very, very different cultures, and really well into the 20th century. And so there you are.
Right. Right. I'm fascinated by it because I love my home state.
Yeah, it's a pretty place.
It's a wonderful place. And the people, yeah. You know, my grandparents, you know, tobacco farms, yeah. You know, my grandparents from Waddy, Kentucky. You don't get any more Kentucky than Waddy, Kentucky.
Near Paytona.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Paytona Beach, baby. Vacation at Paytona Beach. No, but that's where I'm from. That's my home. You know what I mean? It's like, that's me. Yeah. And the people, my mamaw was the best cook you'll ever have. And my mamaw was the type of person, and this to me is Kentucky, right? If you were walking by her house at dinner time, you better come in and sit down and eat. It's that hospital. I don't know who you are, but come have a plate. And honey, you ain't eat enough to keep a bird alive. That hospitality is Kentucky to me. And yet there's an element to it that has always, what did Mark Twain say? When the end of the world comes, I want to be in Kentucky because it's always 20 years behind. There is an element of it that is so resistant to change and combat.
It's fascinating
to me. And I think back to that, what Dragging Canoe said, there's a cloud over this place.
Yeah.
Much as I love it, he was right.
Yeah, he said it to Boone himself.
Yeah. Fascinating. Kent, this is where I want people to find out how they can see the stuff that you do with Witnessing History.
Sure.
We were able last night to pull it up very quickly on YouTube and watch it on my 75-inch big screen in the basement, and it was great. So it's out there. How can folks find what you guys are doing?
Well, you can go to sites you can go on the website of Witnessing History. It's witnessinghistory.org. And all you do, it tells you how to become a member, and it's totally free. You just sign in your name. And then you can watch the films on the website, including Daniel Boone. Or, to make it even easier, we have our own YouTube channel. It's Witnessing History Education Foundation YouTube. And it'll come up, and there you'll see Daniel Boone. You'll see every one of them.
Awesome.
Take a look. And by the way, if you can, we appreciate donations.
I was going to ask, how can people give? Because that's how you make these movies.
Right. That's how we make them. You can give off the website. It has a button you can push. On the YouTube channel, you can also go to the click about. And on the About page, you'll see the sheer volume of people who are watching these films. But it'll also have a place where you can click on to donate, and it'll take you right to the website.
That's fantastic. I can't even begin to tell people how important it is that we save, we know our history. Our history is not perfect by any stretch of the imagination.
No
human's history ever is. But it is a glorious road to redemption, as you said, and we're still on it, and we still have an opportunity to be on it. And
we hope we can be redeemed too.
Yeah, exactly. And there are forces at foot right now that would like to see that stopped. So I need people to check out your stuff. So listen, it was so great to talk to you. I love you to death, man. You're one of the great people I know. I love your stories. It's been a blast.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Leland. You're a great friend, too. I miss seeing you.
Yeah, me too. Well, soon. We'll get together soon.
Let's do.
Kent Masterson Brown, everybody. Thanks so much. That was a fun conversation. And I'm telling you, the video series is phenomenal. It's very fascinating. If you like history, you're going to like this stuff. It's really good. So enjoy it very much. Hey, listen, I want to thank my friends at Louisville Cabinets and Countertops for sponsoring this podcast. They are fantastic. And of course, as you know, I've talked about them working on our kitchen so many times. Louisville Cabinets and Countertops, Tim Montgomery over there is fantastic. And the thing is, they can take you from, you know, you don't have any idea what you want to do in your kitchen to basically, you know, there it is, your dream kitchen. Bam. And you can go to their website. It's LouisvilleCabinetsAndCountertops.com and check out the work that they've done. I need to throw up a picture of what they did in our kitchen, because they took a very drab kitchen with Formica countertops and turned it into what I thought was a really great kitchen. I really loved it, and I'll post some pictures of that. But anyway, you can catch them at LouisvilleCabinetsAndCountertops.com, or you can give them a call. If you just go to their website, it's 930-3304, 502-930-3304. What I was impressed about with the work that they did was their work ethic of their crew. They did also our master bathroom. So if you're looking to do your dream kitchen or something like that, I want you to call my buddy Tim Montgomery at Louisville Cabinets and Countertops. Thanks to JP Web Design. Thanks to Dynamics Productions in Lexington, Kentucky for their help with the audio of this program. You can find me on Twitter. It's at Leland Show and at Zone Disruption. And on Instagram, it's at Great Lelando and at The Disruption Zone. So check us out there, and you can download us. It's a free podcast. Absolutely free on Apple Podcasts, on Google Play, and on iHeartRadio, the app. Just search The Disruption Zone, and we'll deliver fresh new episodes to your phone. All right, thanks for listening. I'm Leland Conway, The Disruption Zone.